Chapter 8. Those years after Joselito's death and the retirement of Belmonte were the worst bullfighting has gone through. The bullring had been dominated by the two figures that, in their own art, remembering, of course, that it is an impermanent art and so minor art, were comparable to Velázquez and Goya, or in writing, to Cervantes and Lope de Vega. Though I have never cared for Lope, but he has the needed reputation for the comparison, and when they were gone, it was as though in English writing, Shakespeare had suddenly died and Marlowe retired, and the field left to Ronald Furbank, who wrote very well about what he wrote about, but was, let us say, a specialist. Manuel Granero of Valencia was the one bullfighter the aficion had great faith in. He was one of three boys who had, with protection and money furnished, been made into bullfighters by the best mechanical means and instruction, practicing with calves on the bull ranches around Salamanca. Granero had no bullfighting blood in his veins, and his immediate family had wanted him to be a violinist. But he had an ambitious uncle and natural talent for bullfighting, aided by much courage, and he was the best of the three. The other two were Manuel Jiménez, Chicuelo, and Juan Luis de la Rosa. As children, they were all perfectly trained miniature bullfighters, and the three of them all had pure Belmontistic styles, beautiful execution in everything they did, and they were all three called phenomenons. Granero was the soundest, the healthiest, and the bravest, and he was killed in Madrid in the May following the death of Joselito. Chicuelo was the son of a matador of that same name who had been dead some years from tuberculosis. He was reared, trained, and launched and managed as a matador by his uncle Socato, who had been a banderillero of the old school and was a good businessman and a heavy drinker. Chicuelo was short, unhealthily plump, without a chin, with a bad complexion, tiny hands, and with the long eyelashes of a girl. Trained in Sevilla and then on the ranches around Salamanca, he was as perfect a miniature bullfighter as could be manufactured, and he was about as authentic a bullfighter, really, as a little porcelain statuette. After the death of Joselito and Granero and the retirement of Belmonte, bullfighting had him. It had Juan Luis de la Rosa, who was Chicuelo in everything but the uncle and the way he was built in the altogether. Someone, not a relative, had put up the money for his education, and he was another perfectly manufactured product. It had Marcial Alanda, who knew bulls from being brought up among them. He was the son of the overseer of the breeding ranch of the Duke of Baragua, and he was advertised as the successor of Joselito. All he had as successor at that time was his knowledge of bulls and a certain way of walking as he sighted the bulls for the banderillas. I saw him often in those days, and he was always a scientific bullfighter, but he was not strong, and he was listless. He seemed to take no pleasure in bullfighting, to derive no emotion or elation from it, and to have much controlled but depressing fear. He was a sad and unemotional bullfighter. Although he was technically skillful and completely intelligent, and for once that he was good in the ring, he was mediocre and uninteresting a dozen times. He, Chicuelo, and La Rosa all fought as though they were condemned to it rather than as if they had chosen it. I believe that no one of them could ever completely forget the death of Joselito and of Granero. Marcial had been in the ring when Granero was killed, and had been unjustly accused of not having made an effort to take the bull off of him in time. He was very bitter about this. Bullfighting then, too, had two brothers, the Anjos, from Aragon. One, the older Ricardo, they were both called Nacional, was of medium height and thick set, a monument of probity, courage, undistinguished but classic style, and bad luck. The second, Juan, called Nacional Segundo, was tall with a thin mouth and slanting eyes. He was ungraceful, angular, very brave, and with a style of fighting as ugly as you could see. There was Victoriano Roger, Valencia Segundo, the son of a banderillero. Born in Madrid, he was trained by his father, and he too had an older brother who was a failure as a matador. A boy of the same vintage as Chicuelo and company, he managed to cape beautifully, was arrogant, quarrelsome, and brave as the bull itself in Madrid, but anywhere else let his nerves master him, and felt his honor was secure in provincial disasters if he could only triumph in Madrid. This confining of their personal honor to Madrid is the mark of those bullfighters who make a living from the profession, but never dominate it. With Julian Saiz, Saleri Segundo, a very complete bullfighter and a splendid banderillero who had competed at one time with Joselito for a season, but who had become the embodiment of caution and safety before all things, Diego Mascaran, Fortuna, brave, stupid, a great killer, but of the old school, and Luis Frey, a Mexican, short, brown, with Indian hair in his late 30s, heavy on his feet, the muscles of his legs gnarled like an old oak with the scars where the bulls had punished him for his slowness, his awkwardness, and his never-varying courage with the sword. With a few more veterans and a good many more failures, those were about all the lot in those first years after the two great ones were gone. Frey, Fortuna, and the elder of the Nacionales did not please because the new way of fighting had made their styles old-fashioned, and there were no longer the big bulls that, with a brave, competent man in the ring, made all that was needed for a bullfight. Chicuelo was wonderful until he was first touched by a bull, then utterly cowardly if the bull offered any difficulties. He was good about twice a year thereafter, only giving all his repertoire when he found a bull without any bad ideas that would move past him without deviation as though it were mounted on rails. In between the beauty of his performances with the mechanically perfect bull that he awaited all season, and his occasional nerved-up, good scientific work with a difficult bull, came some of the saddest exhibitions of cowardice and shamelessness it would be possible to see. La Rosa was gored once, frightened forever, and quickly disappeared from circulation. He was very talented as a bullfighter, but he was even more talented in another respect, and he is still fighting in South America and, by combining his two talents, living very well. Valencia Segundo started every season as brave as a fighting cock, worked closer to the bulls each time he appeared in Madrid, until the bull had only to reach a little with its horn to catch him, toss him, gore him, and send him to the hospital. And when he recovered, his courage was gone until the next season. There were a few others, too. One called Quintanillo. In spite of the name, he was no gypsy, but had only worked as a horse tender for a gypsy family in his youth, was short, arrogant, and really brave, in Madrid at least. In the provinces, like all cheap bullfighters, he relied on his Madrid reputation. He was one of the sort that does everything but eat the bulls raw. He was unskillful at everything and relied on such business as, when the bull was tired or fixed for a moment, turning his back on the animal a foot or so in front of the horns, and then kneeling, smiling at the crowd. He was gored badly nearly every season, and finally recovered from a terrible horn wound that transfixed his chest, destroyed a good part of the lung and pleura, and left him a cripple for life. A doctor in Soria hit Juan Anjo, Nacional Segundo, over the head with a bottle in an argument during a bullfight at which Nacional Segundo, a spectator, was defending the conduct of the fighter in the ring who was dealing with a difficult animal. The police arrested the bullfighter but not the assailant, and Nacional Segundo lay in jail all night with the red dust of Soria on his clothes and in his hair, dying with his skull fractured and a blood clot on his brain, while the people of the jail treated him as a drunk, trying various expedients to rouse him from his unconsciousness. He never roused. That rid bullfighting of one of the really brave men who were matadors during this decadence. A year before, another had died, one who looked as though he were going to be one of the greatest of all. He was Manuel García, Mayera. He was a boy with Juan Belmonte in the barrio of Triana in Sevilla. And when Belmonte, who worked as a day laborer, had no one to protect him, to send him to a bullfight school and furnish him with money to learn to fight by practicing with the calves, wanted to practice with the cape, He and Mayera, and sometimes Barilito, another local boy, would swim across the river, their capes and a lantern on a log, and dripping and naked, climb the fence into the corral to where the fighting bulls were kept at Tablada, to rouse one of the great full-grown fighting bulls from his sleep. While Mayera held the lantern, Belmonte passed the bull with the cape. When Belmonte became a matador, Mayera, tall, dark, thin-hipped, gaunt-eyed, his face blue-black even after a close shave, arrogant, slouching, and somber, went with him as a banderillero. He was a great banderillero, and in the years with Belmonte, fighting 90 to 100 times in a season, working with all sorts of bulls, he came to know bulls as well as anyone, even Joselito. Belmonte never placed a banderilla since he could not run. Joselito nearly always placed banderillas in the bulls he killed, and in their competition, Belmonte used Mayera as an antidote to Joselito. Mayera could banderillear as well as Joselito, and Belmonte kept him dressed in the worst-fitting, most awkward suits a bullfighter could wear, so that he would seem more of a peon. To hold down his personality and make it seem that he, Belmonte, had a banderillero, a mere peon, who could compete as a banderillero with the great matador, Joselito. In the last year Belmonte fought, Mayera asked him for an increase of wages. He was getting 250 pesetas a fight, and he asked for 300. Belmonte, although he was then making 10,000 a fight, refused the increase. "All right, I'll be a matador and I'll show you up," Mayera said.
"You'll be ridiculous," Belmonte told him.
"No," said Mayera. "You'll be ridiculous when I'm through." At first, as a matador, Mayera had many of the faults and manners of a peon to overcome. Such faults as too much movement, a matador should never run, and he was also styleless with the cape. He was capable and scientific, but unfinished with the muleta, and he killed trickily, but well. But he had a complete knowledge of bulls, and a valor that was so absolute and such a solid part of him that it made everything easy that he understood, and he understood it all. Also, he was very proud. He was the proudest man I have ever seen. In 2 years, he corrected all his faults with the cape. He got to manage the muleta beautifully. He was always one of the finest, most emotional and finished banderilleros that ever nailed a pair, and he became one of the best and most satisfying matadors I have ever watched. He was so brave that he shamed those stylists who were not, and bullfighting was so important and so wonderful to him that in his last year his presence in the ring raised the whole thing from the least effort, get rich quick, wait for the mechanical bull basis it had fallen to, and while he was in the ring, it again had dignity and passion. If Mayera was in the plaza, it was a good bullfight for at least two bulls, and as often as he intervened in the fighting of the other four. When the bulls did not come to him, he did not point out the fact to the crowd, asking for their indulgence and sympathy. He went to the bulls, arrogant, dominating, and disregarding danger. He gave emotion always, and finally, as he steadily improved his style, he was an artist. But all the last year he fought, you could see he was going to die. He had galloping consumption, and he expected to die before the year was out. In the meantime, he was very occupied. He was gored badly twice, but he paid no attention to it. I saw him fight on a Sunday with a 5-inch wound in his armpit that he received on a Thursday. I saw the wound, saw it dressed before and after the fight, and he paid no attention to it. It hurt as a torn wound made by a splintered horn hurts after 2 days, but he paid no attention to the pain. He acted as though it were not there. He did not favor it or avoid lifting the arm. He ignored it. He was a long way beyond pain. I never saw a man to whom time seemed so short as it did to him that season. The next time I saw him, he'd been gored in the neck in Barcelona. The wound was closed with 8 stitches, and he was fighting, his neck bandaged, the day after. His neck was stiff, and he was furious. He was furious at the stiffness he could do nothing about, and the fact that he had to wear a bandage that showed above his collar. A young matador who must watch the observance of all etiquette to command a respect he may not always inspire never eats with his cuadrilla. He eats apart, thus keeping the gulf between master and servant that he cannot maintain if he mixes with those who work for him. Mayera always ate with the cuadrilla. They all ate at one table. They all traveled together and lived, sometimes in crowded ferias, all in the same room. And they all respected him as I have seen no matador respected by his cuadrilla. He had trouble with his wrists. They are the part of the body that are of most vital use to a good bullfighter. As the trigger finger of a rifleman is sensitive and educated to the tiniest degrees of squeezing to approach and release the discharge of his piece, so it is with his wrists that a bullfighter controls and makes the delicacy of art with the cape and muleta. All the sculpturing that he does with the muleta is done with the wrist, and it is with the wrist that he sinks the banderillas, and with the wrist, stiff this time, the chamois-wrapped, lead-weighted pommel of the sword held in the palm of the hand, that he kills. Mayera, killing one time, driving in as the bull charged and leaning hard, shoulder forward after the sword, struck the point of the sword on one of the vertebra inside the opening between the shoulder blades. He was driving, and the bull was driving, and the sword buckled nearly double and then shot up into the air. As it buckled, it dislocated his wrist. He picked the sword up in his left hand and carried it over to the barrera, and with his left hand pulled out a new sword from the leather sheath his sword handler offered him. "And the wrist?" the sword handler asked. "Fuck the wrist," Mayera said. He went toward the bull, squared him with two passes with the muleta, putting it in front of his damp muzzle and quickly withdrawing it as the bull's forefeet rose to follow it and then fell into the right position for killing. Holding both the sword and muleta in his left hand, he lifted the sword to his right hand, profiled, and went in. Again he hit bone, insisted, and the sword buckled, shot into the air, and fell. This time he didn't go for a new sword. He picked up the sword with his right hand, and as he lifted it, I could see the sweat on his face from pain. He chopped the bull into position with the red cloth, profiled, sighted along the blade, and went in. He went in as though he would drive through a stone wall, his weight, his height, and all onto the sword, and it hit bone, doubled, not so far this time because his wrist gave quicker, buckled, and fell. He lifted the sword with his right hand, and the wrist would not hold it, and it dropped. He lifted the wrist and banged it against his doubled left fist, then picked up the sword in his left hand, placed it in his right, and as he held it, you could see the sweat come down his face. The second matador tried to get him to go to the infirmary, and he shook himself away and cursed them all. "Let me alone," he said, "and go fuck yourselves." He went in twice more and hit the bone both times. Now, at any time, he could have, without danger or pain, slipped the sword into the neck of the bull, let it go into the lung or cut the jugular, and killed him with no trouble. But his honor demanded that he kill him high up between the shoulders, going in as a man should, over the horn, following the sword with his body. And on the sixth time he went in this way, and the sword went in too. He came out from the encounter, the horn just clearing his belly as he shrugged over it as he passed, and then stood, tall and sunken-eyed, his face wet with sweat, his hair down on his forehead, watching the bull as he swung, lost his feet, and rolled over. He pulled the sword out with his right hand, as punishment for it, I suppose, but shifted it to his left, and carrying it point down, walked over to the barrera. His rage was all over. His right wrist was swollen to double its size. He was thinking about something else. He would not go to the infirmary to get it bandaged. Somebody asked about his wrist. He held it up and sneered at it.
"Go to the infirmary, man," one of the banderilleros said. "Put yourself inside."
Mayera looked at him. He wasn't thinking about his wrist at all. He was thinking about the bull.
"He was made of cement," he said. "Fucking bull made out of cement."
Anyway, he died that winter in Seville with a tube in each lung, drowned with pneumonia that came to finish off the tuberculosis. When he was delirious, he rolled under the bed and fought with death under the bed, dying as hard as a man can die. I thought that year he hoped for death in the ring, but he would not cheat by looking for it. You would have liked him, madam. Era muy hombre. Old lady.
Why wouldn't Belmonte pay him more money when he asked for it?
That is a strange thing about Spain, madam. Of all things financial that I have any acquaintance with, the dirtiest in regard to money is bullfighting. A man's ranking is made by the amount he receives for fighting. But in Spain, a man feels that the less he pays his subordinates, the more man he is, and in the same way, the nearer he can bring his subordinates to slaves, the more man he feels he is. This is especially true of matadors who have come from the lowest ranks of the people. They are affable, generous, courteous, and well-liked by all who are superior to them in station, and miserly slave drivers with those who must work for them. Old lady. Is this true of all? No, and certainly being surrounded by fawning parasites, a matador could be excused any bitterness or desire to protect his earnings. But in general, I say there is no man meaner about money with his inferiors than your matador.
Old lady. Was your friend Baera, then, mean about money?
He was not. He was generous, humorous, proud, bitter, foul-mouthed, and a great drinker. He neither sucked after intellectuals nor married money. He loved to kill bulls and lived with much passion and enjoyment, although the last 6 months of his life he was very bitter. He knew he had tuberculosis and took absolutely no care of himself. Having no fear of death, he preferred to burn out, not as an act of bravado, but from choice. He was training his younger brother and believed he would be a great matador. The younger brother, also afflicted in the lungs, turned out to be a coward. It was a great disappointment to us all.